Welcome back to WBOI Presents. You and I are listening to the Trapdoors March Story Showcase. I'm Ben Clemmer, and it's great to be with you. Our next speaker is Dave LeBeau. He's a veteran of the Trapdoor stage, and we'll begin shortly. Thank you for listening.
The cool thing about the Trapdoor is that we do have a significant amount of repeat storytellers. And if it's not me, then the stories are vastly different from time to time. If it's me, then it's like rock and roll, illicit drugs, and like pants. But if it's our next storyteller, like it can like really... Our next storyteller is a veteran of the stage, and he has told some of the wildest stories, and every single one is different, and that's what makes this show super good. And he surprises us every time, but this next story is... I mean, he took it to another level, and I don't know how he does it every time, but he's going to do it again, so please welcome to the stage our friend, Mr. David LeBeau.
Before I get rolling, I want to thank the Trapdoor and Welch's. I love doing this, even though it's terrifying. That's one of the reasons I love doing it. The 3 minutes in between during the introduction is worth a lot of money, at least to adrenaline junkies, which I admit to being. So having said that, let me start with an non-unique observation. Tomorrow never comes. Everybody's heard that, and everybody knows it to sort of be true. And one of the ways I conceptualize tomorrow never comes is, if somebody owes you money and they tell you, I'll pay you tomorrow, the only thing you really know is you're not getting your money today. That's the only thing. In 2004, I was already a very old Ultimate Frisbee player. Ultimate Frisbee is a young person's game, and I'd already been playing it for 15 years. I talked to all the Trapdoor folks about this. Nobody knows what Ultimate Frisbee is, so very briefly, it's a field sport. It's played roughly on the size of a soccer field. You wear cleats. It has elements of soccer and football and basketball. It has far too much running, and I hate running, but I love the sport, so go figure. It's a team sport. Like I said, it involves an intense amount of teamwork, and if you're doing it right, it can be beautiful. And at its best, Ultimate Frisbee has a zen-like flow to it that is unmatched by any team sport I've ever even seen. Much less played. I learned the game in college at Ball State, which might explain some of the flow part of it. Ball State in the 80s and 90s had its particular flow. It was pungent. I learned to really love the game in law school. I've never given it up, really. After my kids were born, I'd bring them occasionally to the sidelines and to practices and games, and they'd play on the sidelines while their old man played a very young man's game. Ultimate made my heart happy, and it kept me young, and occasionally it would let my soul soar. And Ultimate had never really hurt me until March of 2004. I got word that late winter, early spring, that there was a pickup game going on in the snow, and next to Beach Ultimate, playing Ultimate in the snow is the best. So I hurried out to the fields, I pull on some cleats, I run directly from my very nice, warm, cozy car onto a snow-covered, lumpy patch of grass. And literally the first point out of the car, I get open in the end zone. The only way you can score in Ultimate is to catch the Frisbee in the end zone. And I'm cagey because I'm old and I cheat, and that's how I get open. And I was open, and the Frisbee's coming towards me, and I'm running, and I'm slipping in the snow a little bit. So I have to sort of dive. And back then, I could still jump. So I got up and out, and I catch this thing, and I come down square on my elbow. I keep a hold of it, and I don't think anything of it, really, because I've made that dive at least 100 times in 15 years, and then I've made that catch. And I just didn't think much of it. By the way, that's part of the soul soaring. If you score on somebody who's 15 years younger than you, that's going to ruin their week. But I, over the next few days after that game, by the way, played the rest of the day. I mean, we played for 2 hours. Never a thought. So here's where things get a little bit intense. My shoulder was killing me. Right above the shoulder blade, I was experiencing what the doctors call referred pain. But I didn't know that. I thought I had just strained a shoulder muscle or whatever. And ice packs, love ice. Anytime you clear 30, you're going to start loving ice. And painkillers and muscle relaxers that I had hoarded from previous ailments and injuries. And I just, I'll be fine. And I got worse. And by that Friday or Saturday, I was laid up in bed, flat on my back, pounding painkillers. I'm in pain, I'm in a stupor, and I'm telling my wife, if I don't get better by Monday, I'll go straight to the doctor. I promise. And I meant it because I was in quite a bit of pain. My shoulder was just unrelenting. Well, that Sunday morning, she wakes up and she takes our kids to see my grandmother, and I'm not going because I'm in too much pain. So she's going to take them to Ohio to visit my grandma, and I'm going to lay around. So she was pissed, appropriately so, I think. Either I'm too stubborn and too stupid, and I'm playing this silly game, and I'm hurting myself like every 6 months, or I'm exaggerating, whatever, or faking it to duck out of going to Ohio. I'm not sure, but she was upset, and I didn't blame her. And I remember hearing the garage door close. I'm laying in the bedroom, and I hear the garage door close. And I just sort of nod off a little bit. And I wake up. My neck is killing me. This is not a shoulder issue anymore. It feels like there's a dagger in my neck. And I'm thinking, that's a lot of pain. I need to go. I'm going to get up. I'm going to go get my painkillers. I'm going to get my muscle relaxers. I didn't bring them with me from the kitchen the last time. I'm an idiot. And I'm walking down the hallway. And I'm twisted up. I mean, I'm trying to walk so that my neck doesn't hurt, and I've got my hips one way and my neck another, and I'm just barely able to walk down the hall. I get to the kitchen. I get to the refrigerator. Icy cold Coke goes really good with Vicodin, and I notice that my hand is barely clutching this glass, and I'm off balance, and I'm dizzy, and I'm weak, and I'm thinking to myself, I could be in trouble here. I pound the drink. I slam the meds down. And I know I got to get back to bed because something's wrong. And I'm walking back down this hallway, and my hands are now clutching nothing, but they're gripped up. My feet feel like stumps, and I'm staggering down the hallway, left and right down this. This is not good. See, I'm in trouble. I get to the back bedroom, and I flop down on the bed, and everything goes dark. I don't know how long I was asleep. I'm told later that my wife and kids were gone 6-7 hours. When I woke up, I know that I was paralyzed. And when I say paralyzed, what I mean by that is I couldn't feel my feet. I couldn't move my feet. I couldn't really move my hands. They were still balled up, and I couldn't see them, because I couldn't move my head anymore. I could feel the newspaper underneath the back of my right hand, and I knew the phone, we had a cordless phone back then, I knew that was right next to the newspaper. I couldn't reach the newspaper or the phone because my hands weren't moving. I could move my elbows barely. I could move my shoulders barely. Trying to move my head resulted in that dagger stabbing into my neck some more, and it was excruciating pain. I've had two, by this time, by 2004, I'd already had two back surgeries. I had a decent pain tolerance, and this was nothing. It literally rendered me breathless when I woke up. I was like, oh, that really f***ing hurts. And, oh, by the way, I can't move. And I'm staring up into this light. I can't move my head. And I realize I left the light on, so now all this is this bright thing in my eyeballs, and I am freaking the fuck out. And no matter how hard you try, you can't move anything in your body. And if you're, I think it's particularly bad if you're an athlete or a dancer or a musician and you're used to gross and fine motor control. I had none of that, and I was just, what the f***? Every time I tried to move my head, I got the stabbing pain. Every time I tried to move my hands, got nothing but frustration. And I start talking to myself, babbling, and I start talking to the dog, and I start bargaining with God, and really nothing's happening except I can feel, one of the few things I could feel, there's this tingling right here, right above the rib cage, and my chest is really tight, and it occurs to me, if everything else is shutting down, that pretty soon, my lungs are going to shut down, which was disturbing. I overthink everything. There was no overthinking this. I was like, I'm pretty sure my lungs are going to shut the f*** down, and that was going to bother me more if not for the pain in my neck. And I'm babbling, and I'm talking, and I'm bargaining, and I'm crying. And I'm stuck on my back, and I can't move my head, and the tears are running into my ears. And eventually, and I can feel them starting to collect in my ears. And I, looking back on it, that it strikes me as odd and peculiarly funny, but at the time, once the tears got to the point where it plugged up my ears, and it felt like I was underwater, it sounded like I was underwater, I don't know what it is about that point, as opposed to all of the other not being able to move and the pain, but that's what broke me. And I started screaming at the top of my lungs for help. I've always had a voice that can carry, surprise, and I have always been able to project, but that Sunday, my voice felt feeble, and my efforts to attract attention through the walls and windows of our house were futile. I remember two driveways away, I can hear the basketball bouncing. It's not a bad Sunday, it's kind of sunny, and I don't know how those fucking kids can't hear me screaming at the top of my lungs. But they're two driveways away, and they're bouncing a basketball, and there's a wall, and I'm really not that loud. And I scream myself breathless. I'm still crying. It occurs to me while I'm panicking and screaming that if I'm screaming myself breathless and I'm convinced my lungs are going to shut down, that I should probably try and shut up. So I take a big breath, start doing some deep breathing. I try and get a little bit of woosah, just ooh. And I manage to slow down enough that I pass back out. It's the only thing I accomplished. I wake back up, still not moving, still in a shit ton of pain, and I can hear the phone ringing. And I know where the phone is, roughly. And I can remember shoving my hand towards, I can hear the newspaper rustling. I can feel the newspaper against the back of my hand, just barely. I can feel the movement. And I figure if I can just knock the phone over, just caveman mash the f***ing buttons, I can hook up with whoever's calling and scream at them for help. That didn't work because I couldn't get past the edge of the newspaper. That was my range of motion, about 5 inches, maybe six. We had one of those old school answering machines where you can hear the incoming message, and I could hear my wife. David, pick up. I know the phone's in bed with you. That's where I left it. Wake up. And she's getting pissed because I'm ignoring her phone call, and she knows I'm in bed. And she knows where the phone is, and I'm answering her. I'm like, I can't f***ing reach the phone. And she says, whatever. We're in Ohio. We're on our way back. We'll be back soon. Click. And I'm laying there in my tears and my frozen. And the thought comes into my head that I'm still not convinced my lungs are going to be with me much longer, and my family's going to come home, and I will be gone. And that started the panic rising again, because they're in Ohio, but I don't really know what that means, and I have no fucking clue what soon means, and I don't know how long my lungs are going to last, and I definitely don't want my kids to come home and see me no longer there. And that broke me again, and I started screaming. I don't remember how many times I screamed myself breathless, trying to get help from the neighbors or God or the dog. Eventually, I ran out of breath, and I can hear her. Our dog, his family dog, is a lab. She's beautiful. She's clumsy. She's not a Mensa candidate. She's not bright. And so I decided I will start verbally abusing the dog. Just, you suck. How many times have you knocked the phone off the charger? How many times have you knocked that f***ing phone off the dresser? I know you can knock it off the bed. You suck as a rescue dog. I'm just berating her. And she never, I could hear her banting. She didn't leave, but I don't know if she was taking offense. Dogs don't speak English, really. But I know she probably was responding to volume and pitch, which was both pretty hysterical. I couldn't see the clock. All I could see was the f***ing light. So I don't really know how long I'm screaming. I don't know how long I'm picking on the dog. Time sort of expanded and contracted most of this day. And the pain is still killing me. Every time I try and twitch my head, get these tears out of my ears, somebody takes a hammer and bangs it on the end of the dagger and it shoots into my head. I'm frozen, and I've also learned my lesson, don't move your head, and it got to the point where moving my mouth to scream was starting to cause pain. Eventually, the garage door, I can hear it opening. Ruby's going like a shot, who wouldn't be? And she goes to greet the family. I'm laying frozen in the bedroom down the back hall, and I hear him running back. And my daughter, Jessica, who was 8 at the time, comes running in. She comes running up on the bed. She gives me a hug. I can move my left elbow and my left shoulder. I give her the lamest one-arm hug in the history of dad hugs. I say, hey, Jesse, go get mommy. Daddy needs mommy right now. And she's a good girl. She runs and gets mommy. Mommy comes in the room, and she's looking for a fight because she took the kids to Ohio to visit my grandma. And I've been ignoring her call, and why didn't I pick up? And I cut her off, and I'm like, listen, go get the neighbors. They need to come get the kids. You need to call 911. I can't move. And she says, what? I can't move. You need to call 911. We need an ambulance. And she can see me now. She's paused. She's looking at me. My hands are clenched up. My tears are streaking through my head, and I'm not moving. I don't know if she knows for sure whether I can move or not, but she knows I'm not. And she says, she's pragmatic, she says, why don't I just load you into the van? It'll be faster to get to the hospital. And I'm like, at this point, I'm in more pain than I've ever been in, and I'm trying not to scream. And I don't want to freak out the kids, so I'm just through clenched teeth. I'm like, I can't move. You can't lift me. I'm a fat and you're not getting me to the van. I can't move my feet. I can't feel my hands. My neck is killing me. Call 911. She calls 911. We take a long trip down DuPont Road. Every bump feels like a dagger. So I don't know how fast they were going, but it felt like 5 miles an hour and also 90. And I'm screaming at them because that really f***ing hurts. They take me to Parkview Regional Medical Center, back then called Parkview North. Back then they didn't do very much right at Parkview North. The only three things they did right by me that Sunday night, blessed morphine. That was really good. They took pictures of my neck. Apparently that was really important. And they transferred me down to Parkview Central, Parkview Randalia, which is where they did neurosurgery. I do not remember the transfer trip because morphine. I remember waking up the next morning. It might be 4 or 5, I'm told later. And I look up, and I still can't move my head. The pain's better, but I can't move, so I can't look around. And this guy sticks his face over my head, and I'm like, oh, Dr. Dozier. We go way back. He did my first lumbar surgery. And he says, we need to do surgery. yeah, I figured that might be in the cards. And he explained what had happened, what was going on with me. And I don't remember the terms he used, but I'm very intimate with how the spine works now, and I know what happened. So I'm going to explain it in terms that fit my brain. The vertebrae in your spine, made out of bone, they're separated by discs. Everybody has maybe heard of discs, herniated discs. Those discs are tiny little jelly-filled donuts, and they keep your vertebrae from pounding in each other and chipping. And most of the time when somebody bursts a disc or has a herniated disc, it kind of squeezes out, and it'll pinch a nerve or a nerve root, and you'll get tingling down your arm, or you'll get that horrible shooting pain in your ass that runs down your hamstring, your foot goes numb. Makes sense. Sciatica, that. Yeah, that's actually a disc with you. And maybe the disc will shrink down. I didn't have that option because my disc, when it burst, it went inward, and it started clamping down on my spinal cord. My spinal cord, by the time Dozier got to me, was 50% pinched down, and the inflammation was still slowly growing, and if it finished his job, the end result was paralysis, if I'm lucky, or death. So how about that surgery? So that's what happened. They whisk me off to surgery. They tell my wife while I'm in pre-op and they're filling me up with drugs and I'm unconscious, but I find out later, he says, look, I'm going to do everything I can, but this is bad, and spinal cord, the discs have this fluid in it and it scars and corrodes and it's going to attack his spinal cord. Maybe he's got a 50% chance of walking again. Next thing I remember, I wake up. I still can't move. I'm still on drugs. So the pain's decent. Matter of fact, I don't think when I woke up in the hospital after surgery, I was in pain. But I know I couldn't move. And at this point, they've got me propped up so I can see my feet. And I can't move them, and I can't feel them. And then I fall back asleep. I couldn't stay awake. I wake up again just a couple hours later. Can you feel that on your feet? No. Can you feel your hands? And she's got this little prod she pokes. No, I can't feel that. All right, let's try something simpler. Can you squeeze either hand? And she puts a thumb in there, and I can squeeze her hand. Both sides. I can move my thumbs. That's good. I can still see my feet, and they're not f***ing moving. Shh, back out of sleep. And I wake up again, and I try and move my feet. They're not moving. And this is about 36 hours now of frustration and fear. And the tears start welling up, and this nurse comes in, and she's got this wicked little S&M-looking spur of a thing. It's a silver disc. It's not got needles sticking out of it. And she runs the across the arch of my foot. While I was screaming at her to never do that again, the thought popped in my head, I can feel that. Yeah, don't do that anymore, but I can feel that, so don't do that. And she runs it across the other foot, and it doesn't hurt as much, but I can feel it a little bit. And I'm so happy about that I slept for a couple more hours. I wake up, they poke, the S&M spur wheel came back out. The nurse didn't listen. Hit me. Once she found out that drew a response, I think she got happy about it. So you got to wiggle your toes. We need to get you out of post-op. You got to wiggle your toes. So I wiggle my toes. And then they wheel me from post-op to rehab. And they tell me in rehab, look, if things go really well, you're going to have physical therapy, occupational therapy. Your brain knows how to walk and talk and type, but your body doesn't anymore. And we're trying to find out if your spinal cord has permanent damage from all the corrosive shit that's been going on. So they said, if you're lucky, if things go well, you know, we'll get you to walk out of here in about 4 months with a walker or a cane. All I really heard in that sentence was walk. And the 4 months didn't really register too much. And I was in a wheelchair for about 3 weeks. I was in a walker for a little less than 3 weeks. I walked out of there in just over 2 months, go home, still doing physical therapy, can't type, can't really get in and out of a car. I was still learning how to tie my shoes, but I could walk without the fucking walker. I had a cane. It's a beautiful brass rail cane that you could knock somebody the fuck out with if you needed to. I gifted that to another cripple later. I was back at work. In that 4 months, I was already back at work. That is how I spent the summer of 2004. This summer, I will spend the summer playing Ultimate Frisbee for the 14th year in a row. I've been accused of being a slow learner, but the bottom line is that Ultimate still makes my heart happy. It still makes my soul soar. I can't run or jump anymore. And every summer, somebody asks me, how long are you going to keep playing? You kind of suck. Or how long are you going to keep playing? And I don't know the answer to that, but I can tell you when I'm going to quit playing. I'll quit playing tomorrow.
That was Dave LeBeau, live from the Trapdoor stage. I'm in the studio now with one of the Trapdoor's organizers, Courtney Heiser. Welcome.
Thank you.
While you're here, I wanted to ask about your involvement. When did you become a part of the Trapdoor team and why?
Well, I actually told a story at the very first Trapdoor event, which was when we were in a different location at the B-side, downtown Fort Wayne, and attended several shows after that. When we were doing a lot of slams, I acted as a judge for some of those way back in the early Trapdoor days, and just really loved attending the shows, loved the format, loved the stories, loved hearing, you know, seeing people be vulnerable on stage and kind of spill their guts in that way. It's really powerful. And so one Sunday afternoon, I was hanging out with my good friend John Cheesebrew, who was part of the Trapdoor team at the time. And I had some suggestions for him on what I thought ways they could improve the show. And he said, well, if you have so many ideas, why don't you come to our production meeting on Monday? And the rest is history. So I've been involved as part of the production team for about a year and a half now.
Perhaps the answers to these questions will be as similar as the questions themselves. When did you become a WBOI member and why?
I have been a WBOI member for about 10 years now. Like so many others, I was a longtime listener and never really pulled that trigger to contribute. You know, the idea that somebody else will take care of it for you, or I'm a poor college student, I need to pay my mortgage payment. And actually, I became a member because fund drives convinced me to do it after so many years of listening to them and hearing people tell the same kind of story that I'm telling right now. I thought, you know what, it's time. And what I love about WBOI is that you guys make it really easy. You don't require a certain dollar amount to become a member. It's whatever you can give. And so I think that makes it really flexible for people to look at their budget and say, you know what, all I have is $5 a month, or all I have is $10 a month, and that's okay, and that's enough. I mean, big gifts are awesome. I know you guys probably highly welcome and encourage those, but if you only have a few dollars a month to give, that really, really helps too.
Courtney, thank you so much for being here. It's been a joy recording your shows since June of last year. Before we end our time here, we've already discussed how listeners can go online to WBOI.org to become sustaining members of WBOI. But how can listeners send story pitches to the Trapdoor? And when and where can we look for the next story showcase?
We are always accepting pitches for stories. You can send those to our email address, which is trapdoorfw, as in Trapdoor Fort Wayne, trapdoorfw@gmail.com. 100 words or less is fine for a pitch. Our next showcase will be May 16th. That's at Welch's Ale House. And we start at 7:30 p.m. We'd love to see you out there.
This has been an episode of WBOI Presents. Our music is by Lucas Norton, with additional music from Mark Waldick and Noah Campodonico. Parts of this episode were edited by WBOI intern Brandon Williams. Until next time.
Thank you for listening to 89.1 WBOI.